Morning, Judge Randolph, and may it please the court. My name is Paul Ondrasik. I'm with the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson here in town, and we represent the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, or PCMA. PCMA is a trade association. Its members include many of the largest and most prominent pharmacy benefit managers in the United States. And as you know from our papers, PBMs are in the business of administering prescription drug benefit programs for employee benefit plans and other entities which provide group health coverage to their members. On our appeal, Your Honors, we have raised two issues for your consideration. First, we respectfully urge this court to reverse the district court's decision that PCMA is collaterally estopped from challenging the district's PBM law by the First Circuit's decision in the Roe case, which upheld Maine's PBM statute. In short, we're asking this court to give us one bite at the D.C. law on the merits. Secondly, if the court agrees with us on that point, we'd ask the court to direct summary judgment in PCMA's favor on the ERISA preemption claim that we've advanced in our complaint, as well as our claim that the D.C. law is preempted by the Federal Employees Health Benefit Act, FEBA.
With the by the way, just on that, if it's not preempted by ERISA, could it be preempted by that other act? Are they different? In other words, if we don't agree with you about the preemption under ERISA, does that take care of that other statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Because
that's different? Is a different preemption argument for that?
Slightly different, Your Honor. Well, we think that the district really does not have the ability to dictate the terms of the contracts the federal government enters into to provide health care to its employees. And there is a specific contract that was approved under the FEBA legislation effective January 1st, 2005, which details what types of provisions must be in contracts, federal contracts with PBMs. And we think that law would supersede the district's efforts to impose collateral or other disclosure requirements on federal contracts. Okay. So we think it would be preempted as opposed to federal contracts, but we think it's certainly preempted as applied to ERISA. Your Honor, with your indulgence, I'd like to briefly address first our collateral estoppel point and then turn in the time remaining to our preemption arguments. With respect to collateral estoppel, we submit that it is not the rigid and inflexible doctrine that the district suggests. Rather, as the courts have made clear, collateral estoppel issue preclusion is essentially an equitable doctrine that is grounded in considerations of fairness and judicial economy, and one that is subject to many exceptions. As we point out in our papers, we believe that the fairness and policy considerations that underlie collateral estoppel simply do not apply. In this case, they simply should not be used to bar PCMA from challenging the district statute.
What is the effect of the pending, not pending regulations, but the regulations that are being considered by labor on the collateral estoppel question?
Your Honor, we think
those regulations certainly have an effect with respect to preemption.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But as far as collateral estoppel, don't they have an impact on?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, we don't believe you have to get into the intricacies of collateral estoppel because we believe that proposed regulation represents a very significant legal development that was never considered by the First Circuit. It couldn't have been considered by the First Circuit when it entered its decision.
What is the timetable on those regulations?
It's difficult to say, Your Honor. I know that the Department of Labor called for comments on that regulation when it issued it in December. Those comments came in recently, and I do know that the department issued a notice the other day that they're going to have hearings on that proposed regulation.
In this month, right?
That's right, Your Honors.
End of this month.
So very near future.
How can it affect this case since it's just proposed?
Your Honor, we think it affects this case in a variety of ways. First of all, it's likely that we're going to see a regulation here. The reason I say that is that the Department of Labor has already issued new disclosure requirements for employee benefit plans in their 5,500 requirements. That's the annual report that employee benefit plans must make. those new requirements require the plans to detail the compensation arrangements they have with the service providers that service the plans. And this new regulation complements what the Department of Labor has already done. So we're going to see something here in the very near future. Now, whether...
But there's still nothing in the existing regulations that change.
No, Your Honor, but it does represent...
No, but am I right about that? There's nothing in the existing regulations that change either the collateral estoppel or the merits analysis here. It's the proposed regulation you're talking about.
Well, we think that the existing, the proposed regulation, what it does do, the proposed regulation certainly clarifies and it broadens the existing exemption that's out there.
You don't argue anywhere in your briefs that the existing DOL regulations somehow influence the merits analysis of preemption.
We do argue in our brief, what the Department of Labor's regulation does. The proposed regulation and the existing regulation. What that does is it clarifies a statutory exemption to ERISA's prohibited transaction rules that has been in place from the beginning of ERISA's passage. Mm-hmm. And we argued in our papers that the existing regulation that ERISA imposes under its prohibited transaction rules between employee benefits and parties in interest demonstrates that there is an ERISA-regulated nexus between service providers and their plans, and that nexus exists regardless of whether PBMs or any other service providers are.
I don't want to miss did you say that the Department of Labor issued new disclosure requirements?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
In December of this year?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's not, well, those are the proposed, that's the proposed.
You're not talking about the proposed regulations.
Oh, yes, the Department of Labor did issue new disclosure requirements in December of this year.
Are those the proposed ones?
No, Your Honor, that was final action. There are proposed regulations deal with the exemption.
The ones in December. So, but I didn't understand you arguing in your brief that the December regulations have some sort of impact on the ERISA analysis, on the preemption analysis. Did you?
Well, Your Honor, what we did argue throughout our papers is that the relationship between employee benefit plans and their service providers is a regulated relationship
right,
under ERISA.
I understand that. But did you rely on the existing Department of Labor regulations?
Your Honor, we relied on the statutory exemption and the statutory framework. We didn't specifically address the existing regulation, I believe, in our papers. But we certainly, all the regulation did was clarify, if you will, the statutory exemption that's always existed. The new regulation, the proposed regulation, would greatly expand the requirements, the disclosure requirements that are imposed on service providers to employee benefit plans. That proposed regulation specifically names PBMs as...
Didn't the government just tell us in a supplemental filing that one of your positions before the department is that PDM should be exempted?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
Well, if they are, then those are completely irrelevant, right?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it's irrelevant because our argument is not a conflict-based.
The regulations exempt PDMs or not? They're still relevant?
The argument we're making that the association made in its comments was not that the Department of Labor lacked the authority to regulate the relationships between parties in interest, service providers, and plans. It did not suggest that the department lacked the authority to require those disclosures. What it did suggest is that PBMs should be exempted from the scope of that disclosure that is being contemplated.
Well, if
that's not inconsistent with our position.
If the department agrees with you and exempts PDMs, then then those regulations are not relevant.
No, Your Honor, I believe they would be relevant because what they represent. Our argument is not...
They won't add anything to your statutory now. I mean, you still may be right about preemption, but not because of the DOL regs that exempt PDMs.
It would certainly demonstrate an interpretation by the Department of Labor that the relationship between service providers and plans is within the field that Congress intended to occupy when it made employee benefit plan regulation a matter of exclusive federal concern. We have a field preemption argument. We think that we're in that field.
It depends on, first of all, if they regulate you, that's going to have a tremendous effect on preemption. And if the way that the Department of Labor chooses not to regulate you, if they put a provision in the regulations that say that you're the people within your organizations should not be subject to disclosure requirements, then if there's a regulation to that effect, that also could have a tremendous effect on preemption.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because either way, it demonstrates that the federal agency that is expert in these matters mm-hmm. has determined that this relationship is within the relationships that ERISA was intended to regulate.
Can I restate this phrase of the argument? It would be that you're making a field preemption claim.
Right.
And in effect, that turns on the authority, or in part, on the authority granted the Department of Labor. And the Department of Labor under Chevron has some power to construe its authority, and the broader the authority asserted by DOL, the clearer your field preemption claim is, regardless of what DOL does with its authority.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But regardless of what it does, the fact that it is regulating in that area and has some service providers subject to these disclosures sure. would demonstrate that this is an area that mm-hmm. Congress intended to occupy. Mm-hmm. And I should note, Your Honor, that the Department of Labor has specific authority to issue these regulations under Section 505 of ERISA and Section 408B. So this is not a question of ultra vires or beyond the scope of the department's authority.
I want to, on the merits.
Sure.
There's a list of five administrative activities in Fort Howard. I don't think it's necessarily intended to be exclusive, but it certainly relates to the administrative realities, as they put it, of employee benefit plans. And what I was, it appears to me that PBMs do some of these things, but what is less clear is that the district statute directly bears upon any of those activities.
Well, Your Honor, I think the best example of where the district statute does bear on those activities is in the area of claims processing. The district statute specifically includes the processing of employee benefit claims by PBMs as part of the duties that PBMs perform. Claim processing is the quintessential ERISA plan administrative function.
I'm sorry, which clause of the statute is that? I see. I've got it. 16A.
Yes, Your Honor. It lists the various activities of PBMs. Claims processing is what PBMs do. They administer these programs. That's right at the heart of Fort Halifax.
And what I understand is that's simply definitional. It's saying that PBMs do these things.
That's right, Your Honor. And then if you get into the scope of the fiduciary duties imposed on PBMs, it indicates that in performing its duties, its responsibilities, it is a fiduciary under state law. And we think.
So you're saying it changes the character of how the PBM goes about doing an administrative task.
And that's absolutely within the heart of preemption, because ERISA tells us who is a fiduciary and who is not, and businesses structure their practices to come within or outside the scope of that definition. There are definite limitations on that definition under ERISA. We have none of those limitations under ERISA, under the district's law. They simply make us fiduciaries by status. They don't focus on the functions we perform. And we believe that imposing fiduciary status on us to covered entities, they're saying we're fiduciaries to plans. That's a specific relationship covered by ERISA. It also creates the potential for conflict, because if we are in administering the plan, we're supposed to be acting for the benefit of the participants and beneficiaries. If we're not fiduciaries under ERISA, we're not fiduciaries because we're operating within a framework established by the fiduciaries with discretion. We're in effect the fiduciaries' agents. If this district is right, we would have conflicting fiduciary duties, because they'd be telling us in performing our planned functions, which should be done for the participants and beneficiaries, we'd have a fiduciary responsibility to the plan sponsor. But on the merits, Your Honor, we think this is really at the heart of ERISA preemption.
Can an ERISA plan operate without a PBM?
Your Honor, ERISA plans can. They could perform all these tasks themselves.
Right. So if that's the case, then why why does this impose any obligations on the ERISA plan? They can just function, do it all themselves.
Well, Your Honor, the test under ERISA preemption is not whether the employee benefit plan is required to contract with a PBM to perform these functions. The test is whether, when it does contract, are its functions limited. And the best example of that, Your Honor, is the Supreme Court's decision in the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company and in the Any Willing Provider cases that we cite in our papers. Employee benefit plans do not have to contract with an insurance company or a third party to provide provide a network of providers. But if they choose to do so, and the state regulates how that network is put together, the Supreme Court and other courts have held that those relate to the plans. They are subject to ERISA preemption.
Well, you couldn't operate legally under ERISA unless your operation was, I think, was, what's the language of 408, necessary to the operation of the plan.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So in order for you to even operate, you have to be necessary to the operation of the ERISA plan.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So that is, it's the heart of what plans do, Your Honor. I know I'm out of time. If I could spend 1 minute on another collateral estoppel point. As we point out in our papers, we're not aware of a single case in which a court has held that a litigant is barred from attacking one state's statute by a prior adjudication of the constitutionality of another state statute. We don't think a collateral estoppel should apply in that context. There's simply been no judgment by any court that the district's law is constitutional. We think we should have the opportunity to challenge that at least once. And if you look again, if you look at the policy considerations,
there's one thing missing from this litigation, I think it was missing in the First Circuit too, and that's the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor did not participate.
No, they did not, Your Honor. And they often do not in ERISA preemption cases. Your Honor, I know I'm out of time. I hope I'd have a moment or two to respond.
You'll get some time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, I'm James McKay, and I represent the district government. To pick up on the last point the counsel made, this case involves a straightforward application of settled issue preclusion principles. The argument that the statute was enacted by two different jurisdictions makes a distinction without a difference.
Do you know of any case at all that has applied preclusion in a situation where you have a different statute passed by a different jurisdiction?
The closest we found is that NOW case cited by the district court in its opinion, which dealt with the Virginia statute. There was an argument that abortion activists were conspired against under 42 U.S.C. 1985 Virginia, and Judge Opendorf said, well, no, you're precluded from making the same argument in the district. But the point is, we don't have the burden to show a brand new exception.
Is this just Court of Appeals? I mean, the only thing that happened is there's a district court decision in Maine, and then they file in the District of Columbia. Is the D.C. District Court, is that collateral estoppel?
Well, if they had a full and fair opportunity to litigate, they made a decision not to appeal, they still will stop. But here they did make a decision to appeal, and they even petitioned
so
for
that,
certiorari.
That would, a district court in Maine would also mean that we can't, that this court cannot take a look at the constitutionality of the D.C. statute.
That's their point is that they're the only organization in the country that can do this. Their amicus brief at page 18 says that there are 40 to 50 PBMs in the country. Only 9 of them are members of PCMA, so the other 30 to 40 would not be precluded from bringing an action in the district or anywhere else other than perhaps the First Circuit. So they're not the only representative.
Do you have any indication of the scale of those?
All I know is that there are, the amicus brief says there are 40 to 50 of them in the country, and I know that PCMA represents 9. I don't know the scale. I imagine a lot of them don't have a problem with transparency, but that as far as the idea that just because the same law is enacted by two different jurisdictions, they haven't shown us, cited a single authority saying that makes a difference, that that's a brand new exception to the settled issue preclusion jurisprudence that's been developed, and they have the burden of showing this new exception, not us to negate it.
As a matter of collateral estoppel, don't we have two areas where the court has indicated special problems. One is that you have a group that is representative, rather like the United States government in Mendoza, right? So you have a group that's representing a lot of people. It turns out it doesn't represent all the people who might be involved, but they are a natural repeat player. The second thing is you have a pure issue of law. The economy arguments are very weak in that context, and the hope for achieving uniformity through having multiple circuit court decisions ultimately to be resolved by the Supreme Court if there's a conflict is at its peak. Why aren't all those things arguing for not applying non-mutual collateral estoppel?
Well, Your Honor, they I assume they've really basically conceded the first two prongs. We're just talking about fairness here.
Yes. It turns out to be quite a big prong.
Well, okay, but the classic case of fairness mentioned in every case is where the party had no opportunity or incentive.
So this is different from the classic case, I give you that.
Okay, so that is a case that everyone cites where they had full incentive opportunity. They went up to the Supreme Court in the First Circuit.
Well, that's questionable, they had full incentive. They thought they were dealing with the main statute. It turns out they're dealing with the district and all the other imitators.
Well, the district was modeled after the main. There's no material difference between the statutes.
There is a material difference. It's covering a lot more territory.
No, to any extent, the district court said to any difference, the main statute was broader.
I'm talking about scope.
Well,
in the main litigation, the most that the plaintiff could have won would have been invalidation of the main statute, and now it learns from you that, yes, but if it loses, it loses for 50 jurisdictions.
Well, no, Your Honor, they had both proceedings going on simultaneously, and the point is that
what difference does that make?
Well, it means that
because under your theory, the first rule controls the country.
No, the pure issue of law argument, The Supreme Court has said, when it is mentioned, that they have to be separate. Here, if they're closely aligned in subject matter and time, then that pure questions of law prong, which is hypothetical in any case, doesn't apply.
And it was applied by the Seventh Circuit in the Chicago truck driver's case, rather sensibly.
Yes, but they said there wasn't much of an opportunity. The issue was raised in the reply brief, and we don't think it was really fully vetted. And that's one.
They explicitly went on to the question of arguments of law.
That's true, but you can't find a single case where that was the only reason that they felt there was no issue of preclusion. I haven't found any, and they haven't pointed out any. The point is that they're asking for a brand new, unprecedented exception to very settled jurisprudence of issue preclusion, and they think the First Circuit is wrong. That's irrelevant, and under their theory, they can go to each circuit, they could lose in each circuit, and then just because the same statute's enacted in South Dakota or another state, they can go on and on and on. But
of course, they might win in one circuit.
If they win, then
they need a circuit split.
Then they could get a circuit split.
But under your theory, under your theory, they can't do that.
They can't do it, but the other 30 to 40 PBMs could.
But just assume, for example, that this particular plaintiff represented them all, that it was the only organization.
But they don't. They only represent nine out of 40 to 50.
But you're asking us to develop a rule that would apply even to an organization that represented all PBMs, right?
Your Honor, they're not like the federal government. They don't represent all PBMs.
The rule we would adopt at your request would apply to a plaintiff that represented an organization that represented all members.
Well,
right? It would. I understand why you're making the argument here. It gets rid of the case. But from our point of view, why does a rule like that make any sense? I mean, if we rule as you wish us to, they'll just bring these cases in the names of their members, right? So who cares?
Point is that the other 30 to 40 PBMs could bring the case, but the other 30 to 40 PBMs.
Do they operate in the District of Columbia?
I don't, Your Honor, frankly, I don't know.
Well, suppose they don't.
Right.
Well, I don't know if that makes a difference. I mean, other people.
They bring a case against a district statute.
Other people would have standing other than the PBMs. You know, one of the plans would have standing. There are plenty of people with standing other than PCMA to bring this action. They've never alleged that they're the only people who have standing.
Well, that's an argument against collateral estoppel, not in favor of it. It's not protecting you against litigation at all.
Well, Your Honor, the point is that the collateral estoppel, as this court has said in Yamaha and other cases, doesn't depend on the fact that there are differences in the laws of the two jurisdictions if the issues are the same. And here, this is a classic collateral, they've made a tactical decision to sue as an organization, and they should live with the consequences. They now say it's unfair, but the law will develop without PCMA if people don't agree with the statute. But
there goes your efficiency argument.
Well, but efficiencies, there are a lot of policies that are, you know, served by issue preclusion. You've got consistency in judgment. You've got the basic fairness to the other litigants.
You get consistency in judgment by preventing any judgment.
Well, no, Your Honor, the point is that this is a classic issue preclusion case, and they haven't shown any grounds for an exception. I think that
the Department of Labor promulgates the regulations that they propose, then the collateral estoppel argument that you're making disappears.
I don't know. It depends upon what the regulations read. I've read the regulations, and they're looking at.
You didn't hear my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
My question was, if the Department of Justice promulgates the regulations it has proposed, then your collateral estoppel argument falls apart.
I don't.
It's a change in the law.
I don't think the law. I don't think I've read the regulations. They don't apply to PBMs. I think you would.
They don't apply. I thought they were required.
The only way you know. You would think they would is because there's something in the preamble about it. But if the actual regulations talk about financial service providers, they don't talk about PBMs. You really have to strain yourself to think that they apply. The point is, we don't know what
the Department of Labor thinks they apply.
Well, there's something in the preamble.
Yes, right.
Your Honor, this might be years away or never, and I don't think that this proposed rulemaking should if. The rulemaking does end up with a special PBM section, then they could argue they're preempted, but that hasn't happened, and who knows whether it will. Your Honor, I'd like to turn to the ERISA preemption. The act is not preempted by ERISA. It comes with a strong presumption against preemption because it is a public health statute with under the traditional police powers. It doesn't have a connection with ERISA plans. It doesn't say who gets benefits when.
Slow down.
Yes.
With respect to the plan administration, are you saying the district law has no impact on plan administration?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
How is that?
None whatever. It doesn't say who gets benefits, how they get benefits, how much benefits.
But it changes the relationship with respect to the plan and the PMB, PBM, with respect to claims processing.
No,
right?
It doesn't, Your Honor.
It doesn't?
It doesn't have any effect on claims processing. It has nothing to do with the beneficiaries. Have no standing under this statute. It deals with the third-party provider in a very, very limited area.
In the third-party provider's relationship to the plan in connection with administering the plan.
It has connection with the third parties, the information it gives to the plan, but has nothing to do with the administration of the plan. It doesn't bind them.
Say it has nothing to do with the administration of the plan. It has what you're saying. It has to do with the administration of the plan in a way that DC thinks is good.
It has at most an indirect economic impact on the plan, which the Supreme Court has said in Dillingham and Travelers is not enough.
No, it's more than an indirect impact because it changes the relationship between the plan and the PBM.
But
right.
it has no relationship. It has no effect on the relationship of the plan to the beneficiary. So if the plan is hiring PBM to administer the plan,
well, it does because it changes the decisions of the PBM with respect to what drugs are provided to beneficiaries. Right.
What it does is that's
the object of it, as I understand.
The object is to lower the price of drugs,
yes.
And to avoid to have transparency in the dealings, but that has nothing to do with the administration of the plan. Even if it's true that PBMs have taken over some of the administrative plans, the fact we define it to include claims processing doesn't mean that it has any impact on claims processing, and it does not. It only requires disclosure of certain information subject to confidentiality, and it requires some passing on of profits in very limited cases, but it has nothing to do with the administration of the plans. It doesn't have a it imposes only ministerial duties. It doesn't give them any discretion. To be an ERISA fiduciary, you have to have discretion. The AccessRx Act gives no discretion whatever to a PBM. It requires certain things, but no discretion.
PBM substitutes drugs, right?
That part was deleted by the amendment. That thing, that generic substitution thing, was deleted, and we indicate in our appendix, our statutory addendum, it was stricken out. As we don't do the replacement of generic drugs, except for the passing on the so that's not covered by the AccessRx Act anymore. The point is it doesn't have a connection with, it certainly doesn't have a reference to, because it applies to all sorts of plans that are not ERISA plans, individual.
That doesn't get you out of the reference to component, as is shown by the outcome in Greater Washington. After the Supreme Court decision in Greater Washington, the result was that you had a D.C. law that applied to ERISA-exempt plans and did not apply to ERISA plans.
But in Greater Washington, you had to look at the ERISA plan to calculate the benefits. Therefore, it fell in the other reference to requirement that it was an ERISA plan was absolutely essential to the existence of the law. In this case,
it was only essential with reference to the law insofar as it covered ERISA plans.
Well, this, of course, was a pre-Travelers case, and after Travelers, which has a sea change in ERISA law, where it starts with something that public health laws are not preempted, I don't think that it's that persuasive anymore. The point is that the PBM...
We're instructed not to disregard Supreme Court decisions just because they're arguably...
But I think it's clearly distinguishable, because it was absolutely essential to the operation of that act that you had an ERISA plan. In this case,
why isn't
it's not here.
Under the phrase 4A3, talking about an employer that contracts with a entity to provide prescription drug benefits, why doesn't that require one to look at employer plans?
It's indifferent to whether it's an ERISA plan or not.
So was the DC statute of Greater Washington.
Doesn't depend upon ERISA plans for its operation.
Neither did the one in Greater Washington.
Well, I understand the Greater Washington. It depended upon the plan for its existence. Here,
Did it depend on the?
Well, because you had to calculate the benefits. You had to know what the plan said.
That was true with non-exempt employer plans, but it was not true that the statute could go on functioning
perfectly well
with respect to exempt plans.
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing in the Act that mentions ERISA plans. It applies to all these individual employee plan individual plans that are not ERISA plans.
Greater Washington doesn't refer
well,
to ERISA plans.
Your Honor, I think Greater Washington has been superseded by Travelers and is distinguishable, because in that case you really had to have an ERISA plan to calculate your benefits. In any case, I think after Travelers, it's clear that this does not have a reference to. It doesn't provide an alternative enforcement mechanism. I think it's a rather far-fetched interpretation that a beneficiary would have any rights. It specifically limits standing to the Attorney General, and only to get a civil fine. There's absolutely no right under the plan for an individual to do anything or have any standing to take any action. Therefore, it doesn't have an alternative enforcement mechanism. Now, one final thing about this.
Is there any difference between in preemption between Washington, or the District of Columbia and a state?
No, Your Honor, I don't think in this case there would be any difference.
Was the statute laid before Congress?
Yes, Your Honor, this statute did have a 30 legislative day layover period before Congress, before it took effect. So it is, that is one additional factor.
Has this ever come up? I mean, the question, this is a federal statute.
It's under delegated authority, delegated by Congress under its constitutional power under Clause 17, right. Section 8. So it is a, it does have that effect, but.
And that has no effect on preemption? I know we have, well, we have Greater Washington, but does ERISA define state as including the District of Columbia?
Yes, I am sure it does. The district is defined. The district is defined as a state in about 500 statutes, and ERISA, I'm sure, is one of them, section. But anyway, I could get you that. The one point I want to make is under Cipollone, that case of Supreme Court, which dealt with the another statute, if this court feels that parts of the AccessRx Act go too far, I think the court has an obligation under Cipollone to construe the provisions narrowly so that they do not are not preempted under ERISA. And I think that there's a lot of speculation.
How would we do that here?
Pardon me?
How would we do that here?
Well, I was really basically the alternative enforcement mechanism argument that was aimed at that.
Wouldn't we just say that part is preempted?
Well, you could say that it cannot be construed to allow a private right of action, and that would be a construction that would prevent an alternative enforcement mechanism argument.
Court, if you're a state, does a federal court have the authority to construe state law?
I think that you can
interpret state law to avoid constitutional authority.
Well, under the Cipollone case, I think the point is that you could say that to the extent.
Why wouldn't we just say that only that is preempted?
Pardon me?
Why wouldn't we just say that only that is preempted?
Well, the point is that we believe that the statute is sound and that it's not preempted under ERISA. FEHIBA, which only applies to the nature, provision, or extent of coverage or benefits, the act of the council has nothing to do with coverage or benefits. It only deals with a third-party provider and only in a very limited area that has nothing to do with the administration of the plan. It just transparency and disgorgement of some profits, which were in some limited circumstances, but nothing to do.
So this was not promulgated in order to help the people who were the beneficiaries of ERISA.
Of course it was. So it was by transparency. It means that if a PBM is getting a 90% profit, the health plan will know that, and the health plan might say, well, maybe you only should get a 40% profit instead of a 90% profit, and that will lower the price of drugs. So the intent of the act is to have a salutary effect, a blue skies, transparency, and fair dealing sort of effect on the relationship between a third-party provider, which is not an ERISA fiduciary at all, PBM, and the plans. But the impact of the statute has absolutely nothing to do with the administration of the plans. In closing, we believe the First Circuit decision is very sound, and it is, given the extensive litigation of this issue in the First Circuit, and the ability of other PBMs, if they want to litigate it in other places, we believe that this court should hold, affirm the district court on the grounds that of issue preclusion, and if not, I think this court should enter summary judgment on the grounds of the fact that we are not, the act is not preempted by ERISA or otherwise constitutionally infirm. Does this court have any further questions? Well, thank you very much.
You have no time remaining, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Your Honor, I'll be brief. First of all, with the respect to your question about whether the district's law was considered a state law, there's a specific provision in ERISA. It's section 514C1. That's the preemption provision. It says the term state law shall includes all laws, decisions, rules, regulations, or other state action having the effect of law of any state, a law of the United States applicable only to the District of Columbia shall be treated as a state law rather than a law of the United States. So that issue is this is a state law for ERISA preemption purposes. With respect to the proposed regulation, whether it applies to PBMs, I think my learned opponent is simply dead wrong on that point. The preamble specifically mentions PBMs, and if you get into the regulation itself, it regulates it. It applies to third-party administrators. PBMs are identified in the preamble as third-party administrators. I think there's no question that this regulation, as promulgated, would apply to PBMs. And we believe that it has a dramatic effect on the collateral estoppel issues in this case, whether it's ultimately adopted. Certainly, if it is adopted in the form it's been promulgated, we think collateral estoppel is a dead issue because there's a direct conflict. Whether or not it's adopted, it represents the department's interpretation that this relationship is within the field of ERISA's concern. Thank you, Your Honor.
I just have a question. The size of the PBMs that are not members of the organization?
Your Honor, I don't have a specific...
You don't know.
But I do know based on what the district told us. They said that our members represent about 70% of the...
Business.
Of the business. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case